WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
There's a new pooper scooper law in Philadelphia just passed. It will give you dog owners something extra to carry around. With me is Dr. Alan Beck, who helped to draft this bill in New York when it was written there. He became basically the spokesperson also for the bill. And this was when he served as the director of the Bureau of Animal Affairs in the New York City Health Department. Well, Dr. Alan Beck is now with the School of Veterinary Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, where he directs the new Center for Interaction of Animals and Society. His own interesting research has included studying stray dogs and their interactions with the neighborhoods that they live in. In order to do this study, he spent a lot of time tracking strays through neighborhoods, down alleys. It's sometimes street people, the homeless, bagmen and women, who actually compete with strays and with the rats of the neighborhood for food. He also spent some time following bag people and learning about their seasonal living habits and their survival techniques, which we're going to discuss. Some of his current research involves studying how pets interact with their owners, particularly when their owners are elderly. We'll be getting into different aspects of Alan Beck's research. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Yep. Thank you.
Since dog owners are now faced with basically two new legalities, the pooper scooper bill and the 6-foot leash in park areas, I'd like to talk about those before we get to some other areas of your research. When you helped to get into effect the pooper scooper bill in New York, what were the immediate effects? Did people complain about it but ultimately follow it?
And I suppose we should make it clear that I didn't leave New York to come to Philadelphia because of the scoop law. I wasn't driven out. I went voluntarily. The real impact was positive because at that time the mayor of New York and the press took it seriously. And that was really the difference. In the city of Buffalo, New York, where the law was also passed, it was not taken seriously, and you never hear of Buffalo. And you never hear of it being any cleaner or being very effective. As a matter of fact, the law was passed at the state level, not the New York City level, because of the political problems. Politicians, I think, feel obligated to be very sensitive and to the needs of animal owners. Although they are not the majority, they tend to be very passionate in their interests, like any single-issue voter, and tend to have good memories for those people who are perceived to be positive towards animals. And for some reason, politicians, I think, looked at the scoop law as being anti-animal, which was a mistake and definitely not true. So it never got off the ground in New York City. The state public health code was changed to make it a law for the larger cities of New York State. As a matter of fact, the New York Times published the story by saying that today in New York City, people must clean up after their dogs. This also applies to Buffalo. The point was, once the law passed in New York City and the mayor said, I want it done, I want it enforced, he made all the agencies involved, the sanitation department, health department, police department, city housing, even air resources, to really, especially for the first 6 months, to alert people to the law, to give out warning violations. And the newspapers took it seriously, saying, and even our own inquiry sort of said the same thing, that although the country is in problem, is in trouble, and there are economic problems, and there's and so on, there's high unemployment, this does not mean we have to live in filth. You know, just because it sounds trivial in comparison does not mean that we shouldn't also take this seriously. And once it was taken seriously, it started working very well. People weren't embarrassed to clean up after their animal because it was expected.
Well, it's no fun to step in dog excrement, but besides the fact that you have to scrape it off your shoe and you're going to track it on your rug and leave it in your car and it really smells terrible, what are some of the serious health problems to people and to animals that having a lot of dog excrement in the street can cause?
I mean, it's been very obvious for a long time that human waste is a very serious problem, and in fact, probably unquestionably, the greatest improvement in lifespan has been the invention of the flush toilet. And there's no reason to assume that animal waste is also not the best thing for you. Dog waste has some some very interesting special problems. Dogs are almost routinely parasitized by gut worms, Toxocaricanus being the most common. It is the worm you deworm your dogs for. The eggs are passed in copious numbers out in the feces, and if they're allowed to stay in the environment, they actually need some 3 to 6 weeks to become infective. If not, if another dog ingests them or even a human ingests them, they just get passed out again. But if they actually become infective, they hatch in the body that ingests them, be it a dog or a human being playing in contaminated soil. They hatch in the body and migrate, in humans at least, somewhat aberrantly, because it really is a dog parasite. And the disease or the syndrome is called visceral larva migrans, literally larvae migrating through the viscera, through the guts. And depending on which organs they end up in, you get a variety of different symptoms presented. Needless to say, the average age victim is 6. That is someone old enough to be playing in parks, but also not old enough to know better than to keep his hands out of his mouth. And the syndrome that's best identified is when the egg larvae migrates to the eye, oculotoxocara, because you can literally see the larvae in the eye. When it goes to other parts of the body, diagnosis is very difficult, and in fact, the real frequency of the disease is not well appreciated at all. Only very recently, probably in the last 5 years, has a blood test been developed to at least identify people who have antibodies to this larvae in their body. And serological studies are now being done by the federal government, by Larry Glickman at the University of Pennsylvania Veterinary School, is one of the developers of the serological tests. And frequencies are running anywhere from 4 to 20% around the country of young people that have elevated titers. This does not mean you're sick, necessarily. Many of us get diseases, our body fights them off. You might have a short bout of symptoms that go undiagnosed. You have the antibodies, but you're fine. And in some of the studies we did in New York City, most children actually just recover without any noticeable sequelae. But there is a very, very low frequency of true problems. Eye damage, blindness, neurological damage if it goes through the spine or brain, wheezing and coughing if the larvae migrate through the lungs. So it is a low frequency, real problem. Obviously, it's also a problem for dogs, because after you deworm your dog, you let your dog run free, and first thing it does is it eats another dog's waste, which is what dogs do, and gets recontaminated with worms. So the health problems associated with waste are very legitimate, as well as, of course, the problems of sewer of running off into streams, adjacent waterway. Very subtle problem. Waste that's allowed to sit on the streets is the major source of breeding, at least in the urban environment, of the house fly. It's really crazy to buy sprays and put screens on all your windows and never bother paying any attention to what's breeding flies to begin with.
So now Philadelphia dog owners are going to be required by law to pick up their dog's feces. What kind of recommendations do you have to our listeners as to how to go about collecting it, what to carry it in? Just some, you've been through this already.
I could have been, I suspect, independently wealthy if I wanted to start endorsing all the crazy devices that came across my desk when I was in New York. Remember, freshly passed waste, as I said, is not particularly contaminated. It's not dangerous in terms of the eggs. Now, there obviously is bacteria in dog waste. And you should practice at least as much hygiene as you do in handling your own child's waste, your own waste. And that is, try to avoid contact. If it does, wash your hands, especially before you eat. But just picking the material up with paper, plastic bags, closing it off, wrapping the paper so it doesn't attract flies if you're going to throw it in the basket, and then discarding it. I think the city of Philadelphia has to decide whether they want to encourage people to throw it down the sewers or not. Frankly, I would think it would be fine. All these years it's been washed down the sewers anyway after every rainstorm. But that's only true if you use paper as opposed to plastic or something that's going to float and not be particularly degradable in the sewer system. If you clean it up with paper, we felt there was no problem in New York, and I suppose it's a decision that has to be made here in Philadelphia. Just being clean, as you would with any waste that you want to get rid of.
Well, okay, if you're not going to flush it down the toilet, what are you going to do with it? Because if you put it in the garbage is going to really stink.
Well, of course, during the winter, that's not a problem. It's funny, we did not see that much of a problem. If it's wrapped and thrown in either closed barrels or even some of the open baskets, we had, in the 2 years of experience, very, very few complaints or problems. I suspect a lot of people just put it in the trash cans that have covers, and usually it's just no problem. It's collected often enough, about every 3 days. or throwing it down the sewer, or bringing it home and flushing it down the toilet. I'm weary of letting all the possible problems become a distraction from the issue, and that is there are ways of solving it. Collecting it in biodegradable paper of some sort or another, wrapping it and putting it where it'll be collected properly.
So everyone's going to complain if they get a ticket for this, but that's what you want to see. You want to see heavy enforcement of this law.
I think enforcement is important, not for the punitive aspect, but really to help the people who do cooperate. It sets a pattern. It says that what you're doing is not silly and trivial. Our culture is very ambivalent where animals are concerned. We take it very seriously. As I said, politicians are very cautious with animal owners, but at the same time, there's a kind of distrust of our appreciation of animals. And so we have to help the animal owner, because sometimes animal ownership is trivialized, and our culture has enough problems dealing with waste as it is, in terms of feeling comfortable talking about it and doing something about it. So if it's well enforced, and if it's made clear that this is a really responsible thing that we're doing. You know, it is so odd in our culture that we think nothing of having $500 fines of people who throw a beer can out onto the highway. In fact, cleaning up highways and streams is highly patriotic. Cleaning up after your dog is considered something that a kook would do. There's no problem. If we're going to have clean highways, why can't we also have clean cities?
Okay, and this legislation has just gone into effect. My guest is Dr. Alan Beck, who has started a new and very interesting center at the University of Pennsylvania, and it's the Center for Interaction Between Animals and Society. And I'd like to talk about some of the studies that you've done, and I know some of these were done before you began the center at the University of Pennsylvania. One of the really interesting studies that you did was tracking stray dogs around neighborhoods to see how they lived, what they did. What made you decide that this was going to be important work?
It started originally when I did my doctoral work at Johns Hopkins University School of Public Health in Baltimore. In fact, I had originally, for my master's work, studied the effects of fire on deer and rodents. and in fact, found that Smokey the Bear really isn't a good idea, that fire has a real role in our society, at least in ecology. I then wanted to go and study wolves. I figured if you study deer and rodents, you should also study a predator. And when I got to Baltimore, it became apparent that wolf study was very expensive. The Republicans had just gotten into office. Our grants were becoming less popular. And my major professor, Ed Gould, looked at me. He said, instead of studying wolves, which could be a cumbersome thing to do, why don't you just study the dogs of Baltimore and make believe they're wolves? It's cheaper. It's easier. And besides, it's probably more relevant. I thought that was a kind of silly thing to do. Dogs have been in cities for at least 12,000 years, and I assumed there were ample studies. Well, there aren't any. There weren't any then. And so I just made believe there were wolves, used ecological methods of tracking, following. But unlike wolves, they are actually easier to study. Wolves, like all wild animals, are very wary of people. To the dog, people are part of the environment. You can follow a dog 20 feet away and not change its behavior at all. And if you notice the dog changing its behavior, you just break contact. You turn away, you play with your camera, you tie your shoelace. The dog will just loses interest in you and goes back behaving normally. There are very few animals that you can study in the natural environment without changing their behavior. Also, I did not have to trap the dogs to put markers or collars on them because they're all different. We are so accustomed to looking at dogs that it does not take any skill at all to know when you see the same dog again and to pick up the same animal the next day. After 18 hours, you might want to get a little tired, get some rest yourself. You find the same animal again with no problems. So the dog, being basically diurnal and sporadically nocturnal, is an ideal study animal, medium-sized animal that doesn't mind people following it. So it was just a great way of testing certain ecological principles, such as estimating populations by using different methods of re-identifying animals, figuring out what home range is, that's how much surface area they cover, just by following them, getting a true profile of food use, of shelter use. So it was a great animal to study that way.
People are interested almost abstractly in wolves. You know, what kind of family life do they have? Where do they live? They're nice, but they don't have a direct correlation to urban dwellers, whereas strays do, because you come across them every day. You're not sure if they're going to bite you or not. You're not sure if you should feed them or not. You're not sure if you can catch a disease if you feed them or not. And there's a very strong relationship. Once every few years, someone writes a novel, a suspense novel about a pack of stray dogs who attacks the neighborhood that they live in. What are some of the key things that you found in terms of the interactions between strays and the neighborhoods that they inhabit?
Well, one of the key things I found was that the stray population is much less than you think it is. Many of the dogs that people see on the streets are loose pets. And in fact, most of the dogs that do the biting are pets, loose pets. Around the country, only 80% of all bites come from owned animals at least, and it's probably much higher than that. And what we found is that there's a small stray population that's active usually throughout the evening, which then interacts with a much, much larger, poorly supervised pet population that comes out onto the streets in the early mornings, getting back to our leash law that we talked about. It's quite active throughout the early mornings, and then almost the entire population disappears for the middle of the day, and then come late afternoon from about 2 o'clock on, the pets start becoming active again around 3 o'clock when the teachers get home, and then about 5 o'clock when all the other people who work for a living get home, let their animals out again. And the strays are much more weary, and we've tended to find them in actually lower density, lower income areas where there's less human contact, the areas of abandoned buildings, junkyards, undeveloped vacant lots, fields. The loose pet population, the straying dog, if you will, tends to be more common in higher density, but often lower income populations. But that too is not necessarily true. Dogs tend to be most common where people have access to the streets. So if you have areas with private houses and direct access, you usually have a major dog problem. And around the country, this stray-straying conflict exists. The stray dog myth is really a very important one to have because it helps people blame this ownerless population for all our problems. In fact, they are a much smaller part of the problem than the loose dog. The loose dog is much easier to approach and much more likely to bite you. It's not afraid of people. A true stray dog on the streets is like that wolf, elusive, much more frightened of approach.
I remember when I was a child, and I think most children are afraid of large dogs unless it's a dog who you already know. The adults always used to say, stay still and don't act afraid and they won't bother you. The same kind of advice you get when there's a bee flying around you. Do you think there's any truth in that?
Absolutely. I have been studying the animal bite problem in general. And if you look at the case studies of bites from bears, sharks, there was a great deal of shark bite interest a few years ago for some reason or another. People studied shark bites for a while.
Jaws is, exactly. I think, the answer to that.
Right. Probably bee. Wolf, and definitely dog, and even gorilla, now that I think about it, all show that, especially in the wild, non-rabid animal situation, which is the more common, if the animal has the opportunity to escape or flee, it will. As a matter of fact, in quite an extensive study that was done of bear bites because of some of that death that occurred a few years ago, all the people that froze, fainted, held their ground for whatever reason, either because they were courageous, stupid, or just so scared they didn't do anything, did much better than those people who tried to run. And we did a full 3-year follow-up of all dog bites, and we did based on the police reports, which were interviews of owners, victims, and witnesses. Most of the bites, almost half of all bites, occur adjacent to where the owner lives, against the young person, where the young person was just either walking away or running. It had nothing to do with the animal. Matter of fact, 75% of all bites occurred when there was no prior interaction between dog and victim, which is also flies in the face of another myth that dog bite is somehow the fault of the victim. And we did some studies with letter carriers and with meter readers, and you would find they too have this problem. But holding your ground, stopping, yelling, go home, just relaxing, walking away very, very slowly, very important. Young people being chased while they're riding a bike. Stop. Put the bike between them and the dog and wait. I'm very frustrated that none of this very basic information that could save thousands and thousands of children from injury is part of our curriculum in any of the school systems. I've written articles, I've done this kind of preaching before. We teach kids how to cross the corners, how to turn in fire alarms. We never teach them how to avoid something that affects over 2% of all young children. That is more than all the childhood diseases combined, is dog bite. And yet we've done very little in this kind of education. Again, our culture is a little uncomfortable recognizing that dogs can bite. This is not anti-animal to recognize the fact that dogs bite. It is in their own best interest if we can develop a system where bites are reduced, because dogs that bite get in trouble also. So I would very much agree with you getting this information out.
I'd like to get back to some mythology, stray dog mythology again. And there is that mythology that strays hang out in packs, and that in that kind of numbers they have extraordinary strength and are extremely dangerous and threatening. Do the dogs that you hung around with hang out in packs? Do you think that that's mythology or that there's much truth in it?
Oh, no. Sometimes ecological studies does nothing more than painfully confirm the obvious. 50% of the animals you see on the streets are in the company of other animals. And the ownerless animals do tend to form more social groups. Remember, the owned pet is also in a pack, but it's a pack that usually includes people. As a matter of fact, the well-behaved, well-managed dog is someone who is in a family pack but not the leader of the pack. Often when the dog is the leader of the pack, we have some very serious problems, and that's our behavior clinic often sees that problem. It's usually the aggressive dog that's going around biting everybody in the family. But dogs definitely do form groups. The most common group is a group of two. That's about 25-26% of all stray dogs. Then about another 16% are in groups of three. About 5% are in groups of four. And then the groups seem to be a little unstable. And if you ever see a large group, 10 or more, then you can be pretty sure that that's a transient group being attracted by a female who's in heat. Incidentally, in all my studies of groups of twos and threes and even fours, I've never found a group with more than one female. It's obviously plenty of males. Females tend to be distributed among the packs. Males tend to be more gregarious. So it's a very real phenomenon. Sometimes the pet dog, especially if it's a pet dog that is allowed to be loose on the streets all the time, become transient members of these groups, these packs, which is one of the problems of letting your dog run free without a leash.
What do you think is the neighborhood's best way of dealing with a pack or with individual strays?
The leash law. What we definitely have shown from aging studies, from aging all the dogs, usually by their teeth, that were found dead or being collected from the streets in now three different cities, collected by the animal pounds, St. Louis, Baltimore, and New York, is that the true stray population is not an actively breeding population. Strays are not replacing themselves with young puppies. The death rate is so extremely high that the population itself would disappear if it was not being seeded, refilled by abandoned pets, escaped pets. So if all animals were on leashes, and if animals that were truly not wanted were brought to humane societies for whatever disposal they would be, and we could talk about that too. That's a very real problem and social issue in this country. Then the true stray population, except maybe in some wildlife areas where there's some natural food sources, the true urban stray population would probably disappear if all animals were on leashes.
Well, I've known some people who had a cat or a dog that they, for one reason or another, couldn't take care of anymore. Maybe it's because they were moving to California or they just couldn't afford it. And they wanted to get rid of the animal in the best way possible. And for some, that meant going to a large park and letting the animal loose there and hoping that the animal would have the survival sense to find berries or food in the garbage and keep alive. What do you think is a good way of dealing with your pet if you absolutely can't keep them up anymore and don't have anyone who you can give it to?
It's foolish to think animals can survive in an urban environment. Even loose pets don't do well. More than half the animals we see at the veterinary hospital are there because they're hit by cars. And the average age of the dog collected loose on the streets is only 2.3 years, compared to if anyone out there has dogs, they know they're running. You could see dogs from 4 to 10 years easily. They rarely live past five, and the average was less than two and a half years. So it is naive to think the dog is going to do well without proper supervision. The dog is really very much evolved to be a companion of humankind and is not an independent urban dweller. The problem of the unwanted animal is a serious one, and if you can't find a person who would like a pre-trained, already adult animal, and I bet with a little looking around, there are people like who know better than to be attracted to the beauty of a little puppy, but want a real companion. And by the way, one of the great myths is that animals do not adjust well to new families. It is a horror to hear all the stories how when someone is about to die or something, they insist their animals be killed because it can't adjust. Absolute nonsense. Animals do fine with new families. Matter of fact, it's a common problem if your animal is escaping, that someone else finds them, to get them back because they're doing fine. It is our ego to think that the animal can't adjust. I'm afraid even humans can adjust them. Ask anyone who is remarried after death. So it's total nonsense. You can probably find someone who wants the animal. If not, every major city, including Philadelphia, have private and municipal services to handle animals. We have at least two major humane societies here in Philadelphia that do placements, that would hold animals. And to be sure, some animals are not going to find homes, and they're going to die. Better they die in the hands of a competent humane technician or veterinarian than be released on the streets, where they're either going to bite somebody and be hunted down or die under the wheels of a truck.
Okay, my guest is Dr. Alan Beck, if you're just joining us, and he's a veterinarian. He's now on the School of Veterinary Medicine faculty at the University of Pennsylvania, where he directs a new center that's the Center for Interaction of Animals and Society. We were talking about your study of strays. Now, you studied what could be called stray people, really. I mean, in the sense that they're homeless, that they have no homes, and I'm referring to bag women and bag men, bag ladies. You studied people in the streets of New York who were homeless and who, in fact, sometimes compete, I think, with the strays for food, because you see a lot of people, particularly now, going through the trash, looking for newspapers or food or bits of clothing. Why were you studying people?
While in New York City, a young student from Hampshire College, Phil Martin, approached me, and many of my research studies in New York used Hampshire students because they're part of their program. Requires a real-life experience. And Phil wanted to live in New York City. He was a non-New Yorker. His main career goal was to study primates. And, of course, I was kidding with him that we didn't have any primates as far as, you know, running loose in New York City, though on occasion people in the health department did go ape. But it did also occur to me, especially where I was living in Brooklyn Heights, there really was a population of people living on the streets. We should really be very careful. We're not treating them as these are our dogs. These are real people. Dogs you can follow, and no matter what you do, you're not going to scare them or threaten them. Phil and I sat down, and he was living in Greenwich Village, which is a very good area of tremendous population of these people. The socially mixed middle-income areas are much more tolerant to these people. You tend not to find street people in the very wealthy areas where people call the police and have them carted away, or in the very low-income areas where there's a lot of people already on the streets both and creating a lot of street tension, either young people or the areas that tend to have urban violence. But in middle-class areas, you find these people. Greenwich Village is an ideal place. We agreed among ourselves that before doing any interviews, we would identify such people and... Identification was mainly people that we saw routinely on the streets that seemed to have a disproportionate amount of their belongings with them, as if they did not have any attics or closets to hide them in, and seemed to have a disproportionate amount of their clothing with them or unseasonally dressed. We decided to rule out from our study people who were clearly on the streets because of an alcohol problem or a drug problem or conspicuously acting out some kind of mental problem. We had no trouble identifying 57, 58 separate individuals in a very small part of Greenwich Village. We agreed that we would follow them. If at any time, just follow them at a distance, there was the slightest bit of indication that we were changing their behavior, frightening them in any way. If we even saw them cross the street when they saw us, that person would never be followed or used again. And that if they approached us, we would answer all questions. Interestingly enough, we did the study for 6 months, after which time we then interviewed the people, introduced ourselves. Not a single one of them ever knew that we were studying them.
Does that mean that they're oblivious or that you were really good?
I tended to say that we were really good. Frankly, they were oblivious. Let's face it, people who choose to live in this country's most densely populated city and still be totally solitary are people that really have no interest in socializing with people.
Okay, you say choose, and from reading your article, I did get the impression that your findings were that given the choice between a shelter where there'd be other homeless people staying or living in the doorway on the street where they could be alone, they'd choose to be alone on the street. How much choice do you think really is involved with the lifestyle of a bag lady or bag man?
They really seem to be hermits. I mean, it seems to be a conscious choice. This does not mean that they are not experiencing some psychological crisis that's giving them this choice. Part of the problem, though, especially for women, is that in New York then, there was clearly not enough internal rooms, space for them. And this is one of the reasons that when people talk about the study, which was published in Natural History, people talk about bag ladies. In fact, there was at least four times as many men in our study as women. And the reason that women are more obvious, though, is that they're on the streets, especially at times of the year when you notice someone on the streets, which is in the middle of a snowstorm. In New York then, there were well over 400 beds in just the Greenwich Village area alone for men and only 37 beds for women. This is one of the reasons for our interest in the study. There was clearly our culture just didn't expect, either refuses to notice that there are women who are in the same psychological state, or just doesn't expect to find them there. And I mean, not only was there 430 beds, but when overflow system, they had a whole chit system where they'd get receipts and could go any to the numerous flop houses that were mainly used by alcoholics, but could easily be used by the street dwellers. For men, none were available for women. And of course, the women had fears of using these residence halls. They tend to be victimized more of robbery, rape, and so on. So we have to recognize this problem and develop more space for women, more safe space for women. And that's one of the really things that I suspect is true around the country, and something that we're going to have to recognize.
During the summer, during some of the really hot days that we had in July and in August, I noticed a man who was walking around with a wool hood and wool gloves on. And it was so shocking because really everybody was just fainting from the heat. And I just felt so strange looking at him. And I said to myself, okay, he must be homeless because people who live on the streets tend to be dressed differently than everybody else, you know, that the dress isn't necessarily related to the season. And I can understand in the winter why someone would have too little clothes, but it was difficult for me to make any sense of why on this incredibly hot day he was wearing a wool hood and wool gloves. And this happened every day. Because I ran into him a lot.
Many of these people are so insulated from the environment in their own heads that even the physical stresses of the environment don't seem to register. It could also be, and I from what just very, very brief interviews and talks with these people, it could be that the people who are on very starchy foods, which is what you tend to find in garbage, as opposed to better proteins, are really highly anemic and, in fact, are not feeling the heat as much and actually having heat regulation problems. It's funny, we see skin and teeth problems, again, because of the poor diet. You don't see very many infectious diseases, though, probably because they are so rigid and in some ways good shape. Also, they're probably not a source of disease for the rest of the community because they are so isolated and so solitary, and many of the diseases that you and I kick around or we give to each other. So, but that's it might be a very real problem, and that, too, is a cue that we used to use, that kind of dress.
I believe that you tried to talk with some of these homeless people and get their stories, find out how they ended up on the streets, but it wasn't really working.
Well, It became very apparent after several of the interviews that that these people were just in a totally different psychological set, and that it really would require professional long-term analysis to really understand what's going on. These people themselves that were not distinguishing real from fiction. People who said they used to work for the FBI, there were spies. One woman insisted that she was the wife of a bishop in the Catholic Church. These are people that had apparently had life crises and have really split with reality. And unlike other studies, rather than really rely on interview data, we really just approach this as environmentalists and ecologists, just describing how they solve their life as life's problems, rather than trying to really explain how they got there. We decided we were not skilled enough to cope with that. I had met with some of the psychiatrists in the area, and I even met, because many of the city hospitals would see these people, especially during bad weather. They would somehow find a way of checking themselves in when they got over whatever illness they are or got a few good meals under their belt, then would just check themselves out. They were perfectly in control, and even the psychiatric community agreed that this is a real mental problem, wanting to be a hermit, and interviews are probably no value. So we just wanted to see how they solve their problems. What happens when garbage cleanup came through their section of Greenwich Village, when there was really less edible materials in the garbage?
What happens?
It's very interesting. Dogs solve the problem by shifting over to other areas. People solve the problem by just spending more time, more or less, in the same areas. It is so ordinarily, so they would spend almost twice as much time looking for food the day after garbage collection as and the third day after collection when it had already reaccumulated. It's, you know, what it is. And if you go out Sunday morning looking for the newspaper instead of Saturday night, it takes you twice as long to find it.
If you don't have a home, where do you dress? Where do you use the bathroom?
There's a tremendous amount of hiding space in big cities. There's a subway system that's uniformly heated throughout the year. There are, especially in the village area, there were some public bathrooms. There are crevices, alleyways, and sometimes just on the streets. They are so oblivious to human contact that they do not feel the same kind of social pressures not to expose themselves in terms of normal hygiene the way that you and I might.
And I think until recently, until people like yourself started actually studying what was happening with these people and trying and people involved with social work trying to figure out why these people ended up on the streets and what could be done to help them, do they need more shelters, that people related to these kinds of homeless people as if they were winos. Because, well, I know, speaking for myself, I was like more used to knowing how to respond to a wino because someone would come up to you on the street and address you. Do you have a quarter? Do you have a dime? I need a cup of coffee. They tell you what they wanted and what problem it was going to solve, and you might suspect that no matter what you gave them, the problem it was going to solve was the desire for more alcohol. But you'd get a whole rap. You'd stop on the Bowery in Manhattan, someone would come up and wash off your windshield and put their hand into your window and ask for some money in return. But that doesn't happen with bag people, and you have no idea how to relate to them at all, or if they want money, or if there's something they'd like you to do, or if there's something you could do if you wanted to do it to help them. There's no cues to how to respond.
It's true, and yet many of them did make money through panhandling, and it definitely is a different approach. It's a whole different strategy. Most of our population just would frequent the same area, and then by sheer familiarity, people would become cooperative. Many, especially of the women, would sit near restaurants and would be given probably the unusable or at least unsellable foods of the restaurant, either because the restaurant person didn't want them to come in or because out of a sheer sympathy. And it was common to see, especially the people who would sit on the stairs of subway entrances, to have nodding conversations. I knew there was a person who lived totally on the streets in my neighborhood where I lived in Brooklyn, and all the kids knew his name, and he would talk to them. He would also talk to the whole universe. But there's this kind of familiarity that probably lessens some of the fear, and then there's almost a pet relationship that develops between the person who nods to you on the subway steps every morning and yourself. And it was common to see almost a kind of passive handout. And it's a real strategy.
Does that explain why some homeless people have a sense of terror, you know, that you've got your block or you've got the shop that you hang out in front of? And I've been told by some people that if a homeless person tries to take some territory in another homeless person's turf, there's going to be a big fight.
That we've never seen. But, of course, the strategy would be obvious. Obviously, no community or no storefront could handle too many, because then there'd be the response of get away. So I'm sure there is. We did see total separations, definitely non-random distribution. If you saw two or three sitting in the park at the same time, they would clearly be sitting as far apart from each other as you could get. The only time we saw some groupings were on a few occasions with men, where alcohol was involved, or with women in extremely cold or inclement weather situations where cuddling or bundling together was used, probably because of the for safety or for warmth. And as soon as the morning came, they would disperse and not seem to interact at all. We even went to some of the, in the village, Greenwich Village there, there's at least four places that had free food available. Salvation Army was one of them, and then there was a church operated, and then two private operated systems. Our population, street people, unlike the drug and alcohol users, would use this only as a last resort because it requires some social interaction. And even when they were there, the social interaction was the bare minimum. They would sit as far apart as you could, and if you had to ask for the ketchup, you would ask for the ketchup. There was no small talk.
Did you talk to any shop owners who, in a restaurant, you're either there and you're sitting down and eating, or you're not, and if you can't afford to eat, you're not there. But there's so many shops where you can pretend you're browsing, and you can keep that up for hours. You could spend 10 hours figuring out which brand of dime bubble gum you're going to get, and then the shop owners are in the position of setting the parameters of the amount of time that they'll allow someone who they know is homeless and just seeking shelter in their store to stay there.
We did not identify any shop owners in this study that would do that, except we did identify several church programs that would, several subway booth token people, collectors who would allow their stations to be used, and some superintendents that allowed people to stay in the basement. We had one person who did behind a lighting store, who would stay in the trailer where the excessive light fixtures were being stored, and this is clearly a symbiotic relationship. By staying in the trailer at night, he served a certain amount of protection to the equipment. He was almost a guard dog, if you will, and in exchange, he had free shelter and a place to store his belongings at night. We never saw any women who were able to strike up such a bargain. We found men who would.
How did you start to relate to these people in terms of, I mean, you see people are homeless and you say to yourself, well, you feel terrible, right? But you feel also helpless. I mean, what can you do? Say you give a dime or a dollar or something, and that's not going to do any good tomorrow. You see the futility in a way of feeling like there's really much that you can do to help, and then you watch yourself becoming immune to people without any homes or money or food and wonder if that's a decent response to have.
This idea of urban immunity to stress has been well studied. We all have to do it. This does not mean we have to be the typical person who literally steps over a person in the street, but there's a certain amount of immunity is necessary. Even our own culture tries it. Our own public transportation system won't give you change anymore. They too are being trying to become immune to some of life's basic problems. I'm not sure, though, how much pity these people really need. As I said, most of these people knew they could find food when they had to. Many of them knew how to find shelter if they had to. Perhaps for the wrong reasons, but it seemed to be a matter of choice. Several of the people knew that if they were willing to give an address or go to the bank, they could get Social Security or welfare. They chose not to. So it is not perhaps for us to judge. If they're interfering with people and their welfare, yes, that's something else. If they're not breaking the law, we're all of us at a loss between that fine line between being disturbed and being disturbing. If these people might be disturbed, but they're not disturbing, they might have to make their own choice. Obviously, I think we should make options available to them. We've got to have more housing, got to have social welfare systems that are sensitive to this psychological problem of wanting no social contact. Perhaps we could be a little bit more flexible in how we make Social Security available. You must have a home address in order to get it. But other than that, I'm not too sure if these people want our pity.
That's interesting. I certainly had never thought of it in those terms before. I really wish time has just really flown right by. I hope that maybe you can come back sometime soon and we could talk about some of the current research that you're doing at the center that you started at Penn.
Oh, that'd be great.
Great, okay. I've been speaking with Dr. Alan Beck, and we've been talking about a couple of the studies that he's done in the past. One was about stray dogs, and he tracked strays through neighborhoods, and then he did a study of homeless people and followed them around and came up with some interesting thoughts about that. Now he directs the Center for Interaction Between Animals and Society, doing a lot of interesting research there on the relationship of pets and their owners, how elderly people interrelate with their animals, how having a pet affects your blood pressure. So he'll come back sometime soon and we'll talk about that research. Dr. Alan Beck, thanks again for being here.